Hi, this is Alan Shartrack, and I'm delighted to be back in conversation with Malcolm Nance, one of the world's leading experts on the strategy and tactics of the Al-Qaeda organization, international terrorism, global security policy, and torture. A counterterrorism analyst for NBC News and MSNBC, Malcolm Nance has nearly three decades of field experience in anti-terrorism, counterterrorism intelligence, and combat operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa in direct support of the principal agencies of the U.S. Special Operations and Intelligence Community. His extensive field and combat experience as a naval and land warfare intelligence collections operator and interrogator, wartime survival, evasion resistance and escape instructor, and terrorist hostage survival instructor. Malcolm Nance speaks Arabic and four other languages and is founding director of the International Anti-Terrorism Center for Excellence based near Albany, New York. Malcolm is also the author of five books, including the new book, The Plot to Hack America. Welcome back, Malcolm Nance. Every time you're on, people just love it to death and let us know about it. Okay, Malcolm, let me ask you the first question, if I may.
Sure.
What is The Plot to Hack America all about?
Well, I started The Plot to Hack America last July 25th.
My birthday.
I wrote it for your birthday, knowing full well that I would be able to give you a present maybe a couple of years later of the people who may or may not have colluded in the election. But in all seriousness, the book was written as an intelligence analysis. I wrote it over 5 weeks, where I took all of the known open source information about the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee and the history of Russian cyber and political warfare operations where they were influencing elections and how they put it together, organized their operation, which I did a projection of the information warfare management cell that would have actually gone after the U.S. election, and then how they married that up with the stolen material and distributed it through their laundromat, WikiLeaks, in order to elect Donald Trump president. Now, what's interesting is that people say, well, how did you do that so fast? And how did you get it out so fast? Interesting fun fact is it went online for sale on September 23rd. The exact same day that the CIA delivered an almost identical report with identical conclusions. And there's a reason for that. We're not journalists, you know, we're spies, we're intelligence collectors. Our job is to analyze seemingly disparate quantities of information, connect the dots, bring those dots in alignment based on precedents and analysis, and then come up with a reasonable common sense solution or recommendation with the objectives our opponents involved, and then recommendations on how the consumer, the intelligence community consumer, should proceed. That's what the CIA, both the CIA and I, did identical periods of time.
Malcolm Nance, how dangerous is Russia?
They're a lot more dangerous than people think they are. Putin is sort of like one of those Bond villains. I mean, he started out literally as a KGB officer. We all remember the KGB, right? The old Russian spy agency. He started out as a KGB officer. When he was a teenager, he went to a KGB seminar, an open house, and he said, I want to be a KGB agent. How do I do that? And they laughed and they said, go to university, go to law school, apply then, come back. And he did exactly that. And his job was to run human intelligence agents, people who were from the East Germany, into West Germany to steal computer technology. You know, Apple and PCs from the, you know, the mid-80s, Radio Shack computers and things like that, so that the KGB and Russia could upgrade its military computer systems. So he was very involved in high technology and computer technology and information systems at a very early age. And so doing that, he also learned how to manipulate people. He is a human intelligence officer. His job is to turn individuals into spies and to betray their own country and to do things for, at that time, the Soviet Union. Then, soon afterwards, the Soviet Union collapsed. Russia became a fledgling sort of corrupt democracy. But at that time, the nation was selling off all of the assets of the Soviet Union. He returned to St. Petersburg, where he worked for the mayor of St. Petersburg, and using ex-KGB officers, he became an enforcer. An enforcer whose job it was to bring the mafia under control and to coordinate the sale of all of these hundreds of billions of dollars of materials that belonged to the nation state and then made the mayor of St. Petersburg a 100 millionaire and made himself very wealthy as well. But his reputation was for two things, that he was a loyalist. When he signed on with you, he would not screw you. And two, he lived by the code of the KGB. That was seen by Boris Yeltsin, who was under investigation for corruption. He brought him to Moscow. He made him the director of the successor agency of the KGB, which just changed its letters, right? It changed from KGB. They took out the border guards and turned it to FSK, which would then become FSB as we know it now. It's the same organization. I've gotten into a fight with Glenn Greenwald, who said, you're saying that Putin has been working with an agency that hasn't existed for 30 years. Well, if the CIA changes its letters to LMN, it still maintains the building, the people, the manpower, the history, the legacy. It just changed its letters. So Putin became the director of the legacy KGB, the organization without the communism to hold them back, with unlimited now Western money. And he did that as a loyalist to Yeltsin. And when Yeltsin was at his worst, when he was fully drunk, you know, a full-blown alcoholic and under serious corruption charges, Putin stayed loyal to him. And Yeltsin made him the prime minister. And then, conveniently, a series of hotels blew up, or apartment buildings blew up in Moscow, and Putin rode that on a wave to become president of Russia. And now we see him as essentially a dictator.
Is he a crook?
Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah, he's worth like a quarter of a trillion dollars, somewhere between $100 billion and a quarter of a trillion personally. And this guy, he runs that country with the oligarchs, right? The people who he allowed to become, you know, billionaires, real billionaires, not Donald Trump billionaires, you know, who fake it by holding assets. These are people like some of the oligarchs have like $21 and $30 billion in cash, right? These people are rich, insanely rich. One guy has a palace that's three times the size of Versailles, the real Versailles. And Putin allowed them to become rich.
On the other hand, if Malcolm Nance, if somebody steps out of line, one of those oligarchs, they don't face a rosy future.
No, it's a mafia. They end up dead. And he has assassinated all of his political enemies. The one or two oligarchs that tried to run, he stripped them of all of their global assets, sold them off. And of course, now we're seeing that people who were involved quite possibly with giving information to the Western media or the U.S. government are waking up dead, as we say. So there's no difference between Tony Soprano and Vladimir Putin, except that, you know, it's not North Jersey and he has 4,000 atomic weapons.
I was just going to go there. So he has atomic weapons. What does that portend?
Well, I mean, he just took over the legacy weapon systems of the Soviet Union. But that is power. That's what makes Russia a superpower. Russia is actually a very poor nation. It's really poor. They have the gross domestic product of Italy. There's 164 million people in Russia. France has 88 million people. It has almost three times the productivity of all of Russia. Russia's national monthly income for the average Russian is on par with a person from India. It is a country where there is a super rich, tiny one fraction of 1%, and then everyone else is poor. But they do have access to things that they didn't have in the Soviet Union. Clothes, which weren't, you know, he weren't buying one left shoe one day. They have access to the global marketplace. They have respect in some respects, but Putin gives them the strong man that they want. And as they believe it trickles down because, you know, you have better cars, you know, the number one Bentley and Mercedes-Benz dealership in the world is in Moscow. That appeals to them. And he gives them that strength, you know, of a strong leader that Russia has always craved. I mean, from Stalin to Khrushchev to Putin, there's no break in that arc. But what Putin is a more strategic thinker. He is not satisfied with just being an almost trillionaire. He wants Russia to be restored to an imperial level of greatness. And to do that, he developed, along with one of his philosophers, a guy by the name of Alexander Dugin, a philosophy which was essentially hardcore communist in its center, which was Western liberal democracy is not operative. Russia's imperial autocracy, right, and having allies who are rich and autocrats should replace Western liberal democracy. And Alexander Dugin believes that liberal democracy, as Jeffersonian democracy, should be destroyed worldwide and replaced with these economic strongmen, these autocracies. And interestingly enough, one of his followers is Steve Bannon, the special advisor to the president. He believes that the U.S. government establishment needs to be dismantled, de-evolved from what it has developed since, you know, James Madison put it together and George Washington took power of it. And they believe that it should devolve into an autocracy in which a strong man leads the country with trappings of democracy.
So the press is replete with stories of one kind or another about the Trump-Russia connection. Educate us, Malcolm Nance, about what's going on there.
Oh, my God. Well, there is a Trump-Russia connection. It's not even a connection. Right now, I'd say it's a bridge. Donald Trump has always been fascinated with Russia. His first involvement, I believe, started in 1997 when he wrote he did a full-page newspaper ad in the New York Times when Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush were negotiating a treaty with the Soviet Union. And he wanted to be designated as a negotiator on that treaty, on the START missile talks, right? Getting rid of atomic bombs, which is interesting because it's sort of an anti-nuke thing, but he really wanted to be associated with foreign policy between a conservative administration and the Soviet Union at that time. Next, he went to Russia. He was invited at the invitation of the Russian ambassador in 1987 to go to Moscow, and at that time it was Leningrad, right? Now known as St. Petersburg, or as it always was St. Petersburg, and went there to look at building Trump Towers in Moscow and Leningrad at the time, during the time of the Soviet Union. He went there. I guess he couldn't find that he couldn't shake them down enough for money or the construction standards, which, you know, but that project never went forward. Fast forward into the 2000s, and the Trump brand was receiving enormous quantities of money from all of those oligarchs. Remember, we said Putin's job was to liquidate the Soviet Union's assets. That's like selling off every government building, every schoolhouse, every post office, every train station, every food distribution center for pennies on the ruble, but yielding billions of dollars of hard cash so that those structures now belong to someone else. They were all privatized. That money had to go somewhere. It was all illicit. They just stole the assets from the government, and that money went into real estate. And it went into real estate all across Europe, and a large, large amount of it went into New York City. And they started buying up every condo, every apartment house, any real estate asset, and put that cash into real estate ventures. And that's where Trump saw Russian money come in. One of the most interesting deals that happened in the, I think it was 2013, but he bought a property in Palm Beach, Florida, and it was this expansive mansion that was falling into disrepair. Trump bought it, fixed it up. He had it listed for $41 million. A Russian oligarch came there and bought it from Trump for almost $100 million, a $50 million payday for him. Interestingly enough, the first thing that oligarch did was went there and demolished the entire structure. And many people think that that is the point where the Russian oligarchy had identified him as a person who could be dealt with to be a bridge into the United States. I mean, he was flamboyant. He had a lot of money. He was big into the New York real estate market. And you give him a payoff legally.
He said, Malcolm Nance, that that he's never been to Russia, you know, doesn't know any of that. Is he a liar?
He's a liar.
Well, of course, we know he's a liar.
Well, I mean, you know, I can't characterize this any other way. I mean, it's like when he went to Miss Universe in 2013. He said, Vladimir Putin, you know, do you think he's going to come down and talk to me? You think he's going to see the Miss Universe pageant? Then it was, I have direct connections to Vladimir Putin. Then videotaped statements of Vladimir Putin is a friend of mine. I've met Vladimir Putin. You know, the systems of media technology that we have today, which were developed back in the 1930s, which can capture your image and your words and play them back in a digital format and recreate them precisely as they existed in that space and time, still exist today. But Donald Trump seems to think that if he lies and then contradicts his lie, he can go and jump back and forth between the two realities. The reality is he has had this relationship with Moscow for some time. And the people who are doubting this don't believe us. Go watch the videos of Donald Trump himself saying what his relationship was. Now, how did Vladimir Putin bring that to the presidency is the next question. And that's what the crux of the book is about.
Well, tell us more.
Well, you know, Vladimir Putin, again, was a human intelligence officer. His job was to manipulate people to do things that they don't want to do or to make them do things and not know who is actually directing what they're doing. So after the Miss Universe pageant, Trump was ecstatic. He was all about Russia because he saw Russian money, Russian women, you know, Russian society as probably untapped potential. Money that he could gain, right? People that he could meet. And of course, he just ran Miss Universe pageant there. For a human intelligence officer, you'd have to look at that character and wonder, because, you know, human officers, case officers, intelligence officers are always looking to see if there's someone they can use. And in Russia, the KGB, now known as the FSB, they are known as the Knights of the Republic. They have godlike status in Russia, the way the KGB had godlike status in the Soviet Union. You cannot be an oligarch without an FSB or ex-KGB officer on your staff who reports to Putin. He doesn't report to you. He doesn't even work for the oligarch. So Putin keeps his fingers so that he knows everyone. Trump was invited to Russia by a family called the Olagarovs. They liked him. Trump was wildly popular with his TV show, The Apprentice. They loved it. They loved the you're fired. They loved this strongman figure. And at that point, clearly, well, Vladimir Putin must have seen something in this showman to see him as a bridge to the United States. A big black hole in all reporting on Donald Trump is where he gained his political philosophy between 2013 and when he entered the election in 2015. Because his entire foreign policy seems to be a mirror reflection of the Kremlin. But no one knows where he was briefed in on that. No one knows where he got into his head that NATO was obsolete. No one knows where he became a death enemy of global markets because, you know, and globalization, which is fascinating, because the United States created globalization with World War II, right, with everything that we shipped throughout the world. Between 2013 and 2015, Donald Trump developed a philosophy which was on par with all of the autocratic beliefs of the Kremlin. And then in 2015, he brought on board advisors like, you know, General Michael Flynn, former director of Defense Intelligence Agency, first director to ever visit Russia Military Intelligence Headquarters, the GRU, Carter Page, the mysterious and enigmatic character right now who seems to be doing a great television, you know, shtick. And then he got rid of Corey Lewandowski as his campaign manager and replaced him with, you know, Paul Manafort, the head of the torturer's lobby, the guy who represented every dictator in the world, including the pro-Moscow dictator Poroshenko in the Ukraine, and actually coordinated anti-NATO exercises in Crimea the year before Crimea was seized by Russia. Every player in the Trump camp has got a deep tie to Moscow. Now, in my crazy world where I came from, the intelligence community, we don't start off our questions with how, we don't start off our questions with what. Our first question is always, why? Why does he have these connections? It's interesting. You can have connections. You can have your whole lifestyle. You can have friends. But there's always a personal human motivation behind your behaviors. And the question you need to have is why? What is the benefit of you having these relationships? Why were these relationships developed? Now, I come from a suspicious world, and our world is, we do not view you as innocent first. We view you as guilty, and we walk it back to innocence. And so if I see you in direct communication, covert communication, which means you do not want people to know, between yourself and the ambassador to the United States, who is the principal intelligence go-between for all diplomatic, you know, in Russia, like the old Soviet Union, all diplomats are spies. The United States, they are aware of spying, but they are not spies. They don't recruit people. So if you have Jeff Sessions, Jared Kushner, Michael Flynn, Boris Epstein, and others, all are in repeated and direct communication with the ambassador to Russia, I am not going to take the innocent explanation of that at first, because you don't have those contacts with the ambassador to the United Kingdom, the ambassador to France, the ambassador to Canada, right? Everything is a beeline to this organization. And what does Russia offer? Well, Russia only offers one of two things, oil and money. And that's it. We don't need their weapons. You know, we don't need their mining industry. We have that here. They are an untapped nation of oil under sanctions. And the promise of that kind of oil coming into the market, you know, there's a joke. There's an old movie called Way of the Gun. And the guy says, well, what is that? He goes, oh, that's $5 million. He goes, that's not $5 million. $5 million is not money. It's a motive. Now, think about $200 billion. Sure. And the rumor that was put out by Christopher Steele, the ex-MI6 officer, former head of their Russia desk, who seemed to have an enormous quantity of very high-quality sources, was that Carter Page had promised, according to the Steele dossier, which has not been verified, had promised that if the sanctions against Russia were lifted and Rosneft, the Russian oil company, could conclude their deal with Exxon, which is a $500 billion deal, the commission would be $19 billion.
Wow.
That's not money. That's a motive.
Malcolm Nance, in the campaign, as you mentioned, you know, Trump says things like, I love the Russians. But then when he becomes president, he appoints a whole bunch of people to his cabinet. Now, you say, I think I heard you say, they all have connections to the Russians.
Many.
And yet some of the old Cold War rhetoric sort of takes over. I think maybe Trump thought that he was in a little trouble over too much Russia. And now some of the subordinates began to talk about the dangers of Russia.
The only subordinates who really have said that were after he had to get rid of General Michael Flynn.
Right.
You call Michael Flynn on the day that President Obama and the U.S. intelligence community were kicking out 36 Russian spies. Not diplomats. They were spies with diplomatic cover from two facilities, which we knew for decades were Russian intelligence collections facilities that were involved in the cyber warfare operation against our election. President Obama kicks them out. Michael Flynn picks up the phone and calls the Russian ambassador. All right. Now, he's just the designated national security advisor who would not be taking his job for 30 days. And there's only one government at a time. He not only called Ambassador Kislyak once, he called five times on the same day that 36 spies are being kicked out. One time would have been enough to have the FBI at your house if you were a person with a top secret security clearance. But five times sounds like an exchange or a negotiation. And as we've learned, there was a phone recording of this. It did involve talk of the United States lifting sanctions. And the White House claims that Mike Pence was lied to, that General Flynn did not negotiate or even make these calls. But that's not the sort of call that any individual would make. It's the call that your boss would tell you to make to say that whatever this president is doing, we're going to supersede. Unfortunately, there is a blackmail factor here, because not only do we have a recording of that call because it's monitored by the FBI, if we never release it, you have to understand the Russians have a recording of that call and can use it for blackmail. And that's what FBI Director Comey said in January. This put him in a position of blackmail, because no matter what was said, they could always contradict you with their own transcript or a doctored transcript, or make it look like you were taking money. It doesn't matter. So that being said, he was replaced with General McMaster, who is a hardcore, pure military officer who understands the strategic balance between the United States and Russia, and Russia as an adversary. General Mattis, who became Secretary of Defense Mattis, another hardcore realist. He understands Russia as an adversary. And a little bit out of line was Nikki Haley, the United Nations ambassador. The things that she was saying actually were standard Republican Party talking points against Russia, but were completely at odds with what Donald Trump was saying in his tweets, in his staff, right? Steve Bannon and all the rest were still these hardcore pro-Russia warriors. And then we find out that Jeff Sessions also met with Ambassador Kislyak in an off-the-record meeting during the Republican National Committee meeting. Then we find that Devin Nunes, who was heading the House Intelligence Committee, who was on Trump's transition committee, may have had unauthorized communications or undeclared communications with Russians. All of this is very, very, very suspicious. Suspicious to the point where we are now investigating it, because we now know the U.S. intelligence community in October, with the president, the director of national security, and the director of Homeland Security, came out and made a public statement that Russia had influenced the election through hackings, release of information through WikiLeaks, tried to split the Democratic Party on the first day of the Democratic convention, and that all of these email releases were done, coordinated, and distributed by the Russian intelligence agency, the FSB, with the intent to elect Donald Trump president. So don't believe me. Believe the hundreds of thousands of people who spend their days working in silence, in secret, to defend the nation, and that was their assessment.
Malcolm Nance, to what end were the Russians so interested in getting Trump elected?
Well, you can look at it two ways. First, maybe they started this operation off not so much getting Trump elected, but making sure Hillary Clinton didn't get elected.
And they didn't like her because?
Vladimir Putin hated Hillary Clinton. He had a visceral disgust with her. And I wrote in my book, there was a very interesting exchange between the two that happened through media. Hillary Clinton was making a speech in San Francisco where she talked about Putin, his autocratic tendencies, and how Russia was moving towards this Hitler-esque style dictatorship. A few days later, Putin came back and said, when asked about this question, of course he was asked by Russian state media, right? It was a complete setup so that he would be able to say something. When asked about what he thought of Secretary of State Clinton's remarks about Russia and him being like a dictator, he said, "This is a reason why you shouldn't listen to women."
Now, did you think he was being funny?
No, he was being cutting. And he was going after her, and it plays very well in Russia. But Clinton came back with a rejoinder that every woman in Russia could understand. They asked her about this statement. She said, oh, I'm paraphrasing, of course. She said, "I'm not worried about that. I've dealt with elementary school children before."
Wow. So there are those of us who think, I've been saying it on the air for a while, that if there is an impeachment of Donald Trump, it's going to be over the Russian connection. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, first off, impeachment is a big word. And before we can go there, and I know a lot of people every day, people are like, why is this taking so long? Why isn't there, you know, breaking news every day on this? Well, you have 75% of the government right now is opposed to you, is opposed to any investigation, is opposed to finding out the truth. The president himself has declared this a hoax and that the entire thing was made up as retaliation for him winning the election. He countered that by accusing the former president of the United States while in office of illegally wiretapping Trump Tower. So you're talking about a very strong headwind. And what's happening here is the intelligence community and the media are finding things out that Donald Trump just would not have rather come out. But, you know, from the very beginning of this, and people ask me, how did you write a book in 5 weeks? Well, there was so much open source material. I didn't have to use anything classified like CIA did. There was so much open source material, and Russia had been carrying out these activities for years. They did it against the Ukraine, Estonia, Lithuania, Georgia, France, Germany. They even hacked into the White House at one time and were using this information, that it became very clear that Russia had a strategic plan, and a component of that strategic plan was to get rid of Hillary Clinton. But by December 2015, 6 months into the hacking of the DNC, Vladimir Putin came out and made his statement that Donald Trump is a very colorful and flamboyant character.
Okay, so...
And could be a friend of Russia.
Right. So there are those people who think that all he wanted to do was create chaos. But you think it was a lot more directed than that.
I think it started as chaos. And then Donald Trump jumped into the election. And I think between June 2015 and December 2016, they watched. You have to understand, you know, people look at this from the perspective of general observation and journalism. Put that out of your mind. If you think of Vladimir Putin, you really must think of Hans Stavro Blofeld from James Bond, right? These are evil geniuses. This man is a very brilliant man. He knows how to manipulate people. He knows how to manipulate a nation. Come on, he's got an 85% approval rate, right? Which is just, that's the dictatorship's version of a 97% approval rating in like North Korea. So, you know, he dropped it down so that the trappings of democracy would look like they're there. He leaves one newspaper to criticize him while every other newspaper in the country praises him. So when you think about it from the evil genius's mind, a human intelligence officer whose sole function in life was to manipulate individuals, he would look at the United States and he would say, what can I do to create chaos? Okay, I can go after Hillary Clinton. Let's just make sure she's mired. The Republicans have brought up this phrase, emails. We have the technology to do something about that. So they steal everything in the Democratic National Committee. Literally, Watergate. Because the first Watergate was the Republicans going into the DNC headquarters, stealing files and leaving wiretaps.
So let's talk about hacking for a
minute.
That's what your book is about. Who's doing the hacking? Is it the Russians? Do we hack? Is there ways we can stop the hacking?
Well, okay, first off, cyber warfare is a better way of putting hacking because it involves more than just breaking into computers, right? It involves stealing technology. It involves building technological systems that don't just steal or hack into to steal communications. I can control, with the proper methodologies, I can control every computer in this control room from a remote location and make it say and do what I want it to do. That is a technological warfare tool. We have systems like that. The agency that's responsible for that is the National Security Agency and its joint sister, the new U.S. Cyber Command. Cyber Command is about to become a separate agency of the National Security Agency. NSA will go back to its traditional super spying of electronic things, and Cyber Command will handle the defenses against Russian and global cyber attacks from hackings and things like that, or seizing control of, you know, power plants, you know, hospitals, generators, and electronic systems. You know, with the right cyber systems, you could turn off every breathing apparatus in a hospital.
Some people are saying that we're doing exactly that with the North Koreans and their weaponry right now.
It's quite possible. I mean, these are sub-warfare weapon systems. Russia does it on a completely different scale. Okay, the United States, our cyber weapons are like these sniper. Imagine a sniper bullet that you take months to craft and you only create five of them and you only shoot it in the most extraordinary circumstance. Russia uses cyber warfare like we use Dunkin' Donuts coffee. It is a integral, everyday, first thing in the morning tool that they choose to attack their enemies. Or now we're under this in massive global influence operation using Twitter and Facebook. And these things called bots, right? They're electronic drones, so to speak, that you see on Facebook. They'll have like two or three followers or one follower, and it spouts the exact same message out over and over and over again. These bots on Twitter and Facebook, the Russians harnessed this about 5 years ago, understanding the power of a propaganda system, and they have been using them relentlessly. There are over 10,000 bots that were identified pro-Trump in this election. They all originated in Eastern Europe, not in the United States. And when you look at them, they would have some, you know, picture of some beautiful Russian girl taken out of a magazine. They also have this system of trolls, you know, the people that get on the internet and attack you personally.
Oh, I know them all too well.
I have some experience with them this week. These trolls are actual human beings, and they were run out of a warehouse in St. Petersburg. The New York Times did a brilliant article about it. Adrian Chen, the author, did a brilliant article about the trolls of Olinka, this neighborhood in Moscow, and he would meet them in cafes outside there, and they were like, yeah, they all speak English, they all know how to do Twitter talk, and they just like, Trump, best guy, yeah, right? But this troll army of 1,000 people sitting in there are a subordinate agency to the Russian intelligence agency, the FSB, or to the GRU, Russian military intelligence. These exact same troll armies, just a week ago, 1,000 troll bots that were identified as Olinka personnel shifted all of their pro-Trump rhetoric, supporting the claim that Barack Obama had wired him, shifted straight into French and pro-Marine Le Pen, the pro-Putin's candidate, who we now know has taken at least $50 million from Moscow.
I want to ask you about her, because she is known as having close connections with people who might be Nazi sympathizers.
Yes, she believes. Well, it's not just close connections. It's her Holocaust denial.
Right.
I mean, come on. France lost hundreds of thousands of Jews during World War II, and she just flat out refuses to believe it.
So let's remember that the old Soviet Union and the Nazis were not exactly friends.
No.
So Putin has basically turned history on its ear.
He has.
By now saying, we want to be friends with these so-called Nazis.
Interesting. You're absolutely right. But what's happened here is when the Soviet Union was trying to destabilize the West in the 60s and the 70s, in the 60s they did it, 50s and 60s they did it through individual subversion, putting out, you know, Communist Party materials, trying to, you know, create Comintern. You might remember that, right? Communism
Indeed.
International, which was every nation had a Communist Party, and they would espouse the line of the glorious Soviet Union, and we would send the money, and they would get a printer, and they would do a newspaper, and they would distribute that on the streets, right? That was the old school. In the 1970s, the Russians shifted to military destabilization by arming protest and resistance groups in France and Germany. Red Army Faction, Action Directe in Paris and France, the combative communist cells of Belgium. And these people would go rip-roaring all around and blowing up bombs. There were more bombings by Action Directe in France than there has ever been by Islamic extremists, right? And that's saying something. But they were directly funded, coordinated by the Kremlin, by the Soviet Union, and had training bases in, like, Libya. Irish Republican Army also had some funding from them. When Putin took over, he was not a communist anymore. He got rid of communism. They got rid of communism. He understood the communist imperialism of spreading your nation and your power around the world, minus all that commie stuff, right? The socialism, the state-run capital, all of that. He shifted and realized, or not realized, but when the KGB recruited back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, actual spies, they never recruited from the left. They always recruited people who were conservative or middle of the road who would never be questioned. Because when you were from the left, you could turn on them. And when you turned on a communist, well, you were a communist. You knew all about them. You were dangerous to them ideologically if you ever turned on them. So the Soviet Union's recruitment ideology amongst the KGB was go after conservatives, go after people who were greedy, go after people who had their own belief in money above everything else. So Vladimir Putin realized the real place to affect ideological change was not from the left, but from the right. And he started funding groups like Greece's New Dawn, neo-Nazi movement, and giving them direct funding. And these people literally tried to overthrow Greek democracy. And they started riots and had the fascist, pro-fascist movement. And don't forget, by the way, that Mussolini defined fascism as a dictatorship of the corporate right, il fascisti. Well, that's exactly what Putin's Russia is. It's a dictatorship of money. And where he empowers and controls the corporations. So Putin realized there was far more ability to control and get rid of Western ideology for his ideology of autocratic semi-democracies ruling the West by funding Marine Le Pen, by funding Geert Wilders, the Islamophobe of the Netherlands, by funding the pro-Nazi parties, you know, anti-immigrant parties in Austria and Germany, funding the Brexit would break them economically, break England economically. And then he backed the Trump campaign.
So who's smarter, Putin or Trump?
Oh, Putin by a mile. Putin, you know, like I said, evil genius.
Let's talk a little about China entering into all of this. Now we have President Xi, who you have described. I've heard you describe him as the adult in the room. And you have Putin. You've also told us that Putin is running a very poor country. President Xi is not. North Korea is right next door to China, of course, and has had historic roots with a certain thing called the Korean War. I happen to have been around for it and remember it. And the Russians were, and the Chinese were comrades at arms in supporting the North Koreans. So where does that leave us now with North Korea?
Well, people tend to forget China is still a communist country.
Indeed.
It's a hybrid capitalist economic system with a quote-unquote communist central authority controlling things but allowing them to make enormous quantities of money. China reminds me of sort of pre-imperial Japan, in the 1900s, where they started becoming a power. And they then went on to become a military power. But before they did that, they wanted to be an economic power. I mean, so China is selling things. They are the global distribution hub of the United States. Did I say that? The world. What the United States was post-World War II, China is today. Because American industries went to China and started paying people 50 cents per hour and created China as this economic powerhouse in the 1990s. Now, what you see now is China is focusing on the expansion of the global economy everywhere. I've been in Africa recently. China's buying Africa. It is turning into their grocery store. They go into countries like Zambia and they bring in, you know, cheap Chinese-made jumping deer pickup trucks, which are like Ford Ranger knockoffs, and they sell them for like a couple of $1,000s, and they buy entire millions of acres of farms and they turn them into single food productions. They are building the economies of East and Central Africa to the point where they know that will be a market someday. Right now, it's a food market for them. They get all that food shipped to China. But sub-Saharan Africa is going to become the global marketplace that China will have new money, hundreds of millions of people that the West won't even visit, much less go there and sell things to. It's like the United States in the 1960s when sub-Saharan Africa was a global battle place against the Soviet Union. But China's there. China's in Asia. The United States just gave up all global trade in the Pacific Ocean to China by pulling out of the TPP. China is now the economic power in the Pacific because we walked away from that. U.S. products will not be sold on that market. We will be at a disadvantage trying to do single unilateral deals with all of these nations while China controls the economy in the West, in the East. That being said, Moscow has a different strategy. Putin's strategy is power by nations. He is creating what I call, in my new book, the sequel to The Plot to Hack America, is going to be called The Plot to Destroy Democracy. He is building an axis of autocracies. And his axis is like that painting that showed up in Moscow during the election that had a communist-styled image of Putin, Trump, Le Pen in this axis, where Putin and Trump would hold the east and western ends of this autocracy. Europe, once Le Pen wins power, would be dismantled. And it will. If France withdraws from the European Union, the common currency, European economies will collapse. And, of course, we will have to go back to single individual unilateral trade deals with Netherlands for flowers, with Switzerland for cheese. It's ridiculous. And trillions of euros will disappear.
Let me just ask you this for those of us who are fascinated by what you're talking about. What now is the relationship between China, between Xi and Putin?
Well, right now, there's a tacit balance going on. Putin supposedly, or I say supposedly because you don't hear much about it, created a trade axis with China. I think it was called the Shanghai Economic Council or Cooperation. And I think these two are going two entirely different routes. And they cooperate where they can. But Russia doesn't buy products from China the way we buy products from China. Okay? Russia is still that land of misfit toys where they're making things on a low retrograde level. And if it comes through Russia, it comes through a third country through a distribution system. You don't see billions of trucks going through Manchuria into Russia the way that you see Singapore and Shanghai pumping out tens of millions of containers of Chinese goods to the United States and to the rest of the world. Because believe me, I've been in some bizarre points of the world, and anytime I needed a plastic bucket, I knew a Chinese bucket was within 50 feet of me. So Russia is not viewing China as a global competitor just yet because they have oil. And so long as they have oil, they're taking Chinese money anyway. They are, again, trying to control entire swaths of government.
So is the absence or the move to solar power, I see the Chinese are very interested in that, and here are the Russians with all the oil, there's got to be some connection here.
Well, there is, because China's smart. But 10 years ago, China jumped both feet into the solar power industry. And within 5 years, they dominated global solar power production. Today, they are the solar power industry in the world. You buy a solar panel off of eBay, it comes from China. And it doesn't matter about the quality. All of these solar distribution systems that people are saying install solar in your house, you're releasing it for 25 years, all of these panels are coming from China. The United States gave up the solar power industry. And you had people fighting it. Remember Solyndra, that President Obama, the Commerce Department made an investment in a massive U.S. solar manufacturer. The reason Solyndra went under didn't have anything to do with mismanagement. China, as a government, decided they would take the entire global solar system. They have the alacrity to beat us at our own game. We have the ability to do it corporation to corporation, like the iPhone. Well, there are Chinese copies of the iPhone out there. But when it comes to big things like water power generators, you got to buy it from China. Windmills, you got to buy it from China. Solar panels, you got to buy it from China.
Well, GE makes windmills, don't
they? Oh, yeah, I'm sure they do. I'm sure they make fine ones. But you know those little ones that are on your house farm that pump your water and things like that? There are billions of people that need that. They don't need a giant GE in-ocean wind turbine. And so when all of Africa has Chinese solar panels, all of Latin America has Chinese little windmills that the United States could have dominated by just the most minor investment into our manufacturing base, well, they will own all future power.
Now, your coming book, you've just told us, is going to be The Plot to Destroy Democracy.
Right.
What, in fact, is your feeling about how dangerous this is? Will it succeed?
Well, I hesitate because I think it will succeed. I think it's already succeeded.
So we're done.
I don't think we're done. You know, I wrote intelligence community textbooks, and one of the phrases I put into my textbooks is, common sense is the least used intelligence analysis tool. I say the same thing about the defense of this nation's democracy. What we have just had with the election of Donald Trump is the upending of American democracy as it existed, as it was literally written blocks from where I grew up. I was born and raised in Philadelphia. I was born in Philadelphia Naval Hospital, right? Everything, all of our core values came from the convention in that city. And to imagine that the United States could keep the trappings of that, and I say they keep the trappings. No one's getting rid of freedom of speech. We'll just be able to sue journalists. No one's getting rid of, you know, democracy and not having an election. It's just your election.
You say that because, I'm sorry to interrupt, Malcolm, because Trump has talked about
making
the,
said,
the libel laws.
He'll make the libel laws way easier, which would be great for me. But, you know, no one is saying they'll get rid of democracy or freedom of speech. Your speech will just be controlled by electronic means with millions of bots that will shout down your one Twitter feed with 1,000 fake Twitter feeds that come from a foreign entity that wants to influence your nation. That is already here. It's already done. And Plot to Hack America, I say the American election was not hacked. It was not. No votes were changed. The American electorate's mindset was hacked by believing that the words emails and the flood of all these Russian intelligence stolen emails laundered through WikiLeaks became the single most important part of that election. That was political warfare carried out by a foreign intelligence agency, and they chose the person they wanted. It was not a free or fair election.
Well, Malcolm Nance, I love talking to you because my head spins. I'm learning so much. But the one thing you've mentioned several times during this conversation, I want to go back to it, is WikiLeaks itself.
Yeah.
Now, is WikiLeaks subsumed by the Russians, or how does it work?
Well, as you see, the director of the CIA, Mike Pompeo, just came out with a statement a week ago saying that WikiLeaks is a non-state intelligence agency. And that was a way of putting them on par with ISIS as a non-state actor. And when you're designated as non-state, that means we've given you a status we can attack you with. Now, I find this fascinating because WikiLeaks was the laundromat of Russian intelligence for every word that came out about the Clinton campaign, all of the other people whose emails that they had stolen and distributed. And Donald Trump himself praised WikiLeaks. I think the number is 68 times. I might be mistaken. But it was a boatload of times where he came out and said, WikiLeaks! I love WikiLeaks! Sean Hannity invited Julian Assange by satellite onto his show to talk about the influence of WikiLeaks and how great it was that they got all these materials and fostered the belief that there was no hack, but that in fact it was a leak from an insider at the DNC. You don't have to believe the U.S. intelligence community to believe that there was a hacking. The cybersecurity companies that were brought in to do the analysis literally sat there and watched files being stolen, transferred to a Russian military intelligence server in Moscow. Okay? Easy to track. But what was really happening here is our mindset towards an individual was manipulated. And when there's that word cloud picture of media coverage between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and Trump's words were like jobs, America, wall. Hillary Clinton's was one word, emails. And Russia knew that. They stole them, they distributed them, and they put it out into the air with, quite possibly, with cooperation. And WikiLeaks was their laundromat.
But now things seem to have changed a little bit. Assange is not quite the hero to the Trump forces that he once was. What's going on?
Well, you know, if I was Tony Soprano, and there was a witness out there who could turn against me, I'd want to get him off the stage. And now you see the Justice Department is calling for his diplomatic immunity to be raised and for him to be arrested and brought to the United States and put on trial for cyber crimes. That's a way of controlling.
And what's that about, really? I get the Tony Soprano reference, but is it also that WikiLeaks has potentially become too dangerous?
Well, I think they're dangerous to Donald Trump.
Uh-huh.
Because they were coordinating with Russian military intelligence. And we have evidence to that effect. By the way, I just want to make a quick word about evidence. From the intelligence community's perspective, what we collect is not evidence. It does not become evidence until it is transferred to the Justice Department and it is put into the evidentiary batch that goes on to be brought into a court of law. So we have a lot of information and intelligence about WikiLeaks. But right now, the FBI investigation is so thorough that to the point where the director of the CIA is saying WikiLeaks is a Russian intelligence entity.
Well, finally, and we only have 3 minutes to go here, let's talk a little bit about Comey, the FBI director. An article in the New York Times bringing great suspicion to Comey. There are many of us who think he won the election for Donald Trump. There are others who think he just was sort of out of control, didn't know what he was doing. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
I really have a split opinion about this. I think because on the political side with Hillary Clinton, the emails, the server, and all of that, I think he saw that as just politics. And every time he was asked, you might recall back in July where he came out and made the statement that, you know, that extraordinary press conference where he said there was no crimes broken and all of that. I think at that point he was just flooded. People came and told him that, you know, you essentially are a traitor.
Sure.
And I think that he got it and he kept his mouth shut.
Until a week before the election.
Before the election when he felt that he had to open his mouth. And I don't think he thought.
Rectify himself.
I don't think that he thought that would influence the election. That aside, let's set that aside.
What kind of FBI director was he then? He must have been pretty stupid not to assume that.
Nobody said that. But, you know, he still serves for another 4 years. You know, he's got his contract.
But he can be fired.
He can be fired. And if we need a resurrection of J. Edgar Hoover.
But we did hear that
we could fire him.
Malcolm Nance, we did hear that he went over to the White House and had some discussions over there not that long ago. Maybe they put the fear of God into him. Who knows?
Well, that's possible. On the other hand, he could have been putting the fear of God into them because when he had his hearing on the House Intelligence Committee with Director of the National Security Agency, Admiral Rogers, that was a devastating briefing for anyone that was watching it. He just came right out and said this election was run as an influence operation to get Donald Trump into the White House. And he confirmed that the standards of their FISA warrants are very high, which for anyone involved or who may have made a phone call to a Russian means that if we get a FISA warrant on you, we essentially assume you are an agent or possibly an agent of a foreign intelligence agency or a member of ISIS, because those are the only two ways we're going to get a FISA warrant on you. Right? This is not a normal FBI warrant. This is one where we suspect you are a spy, potentially a spy, or an unwitting spy for a foreign agency. And I think Comey, when that information came to him, it's the one thing he will not open his mouth about. He won't talk about national counterintelligence operations. the same way he, you know, we wouldn't talk about Aldridge Ames when he was being investigated as a spy. You didn't hear about it until he was arrested. But there is so many contacts right now with individuals, and we're hearing that some extraordinary stories. The director of GCHQ, Britain's NSA, the General Communications Headquarters, personally reached out to James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence in the United States, and said, "What I have to say to you is so serious, I will report only to you, and you will take it to the president. We have intelligence indications that people in the Trump campaign are in direct communications with Russian intelligence officers." And that's where the investigation stands. Now, whether that comes true or not, whether it becomes fulfills its destiny, it becomes the single greatest scandal in the history of America, whether we have people who...
Worse than the XYZ affair.
The XYZ affair. Nothing matches this. People say Teapot Dome. No, this is Benedict Arnold territory.
Indeed it is. Well, we could go on for the next 40 hours. I got to say this to you, Malcolm Nance. We love you here at WAMC, and you are, as we know, one of the world's leading experts on international terrorism. You've written a book, The Plot to Hack America. You're working on another one, The Plot to Destroy Democracy, and you are always welcome here. We think the best of you. So, Malcolm Nance, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.